If you were controlling over $70 billion in assets during this, one of the roughest economic stretches our country has ever gone through, what would you do with the money? Welcome to the world of banking. How do these institutions and those that lead them make the call as to which business gets financed, which homeowner gets a loan, and who doesn't? No one knows better than this week's Game Face exec, Scott Anderson, longtime president and CEO of Zions Bank, one of the most influential banks in the United States. And I want to thank Scott Anderson, president and CEO of Zions Bank, for taking the time to join us on Game Face Execs. This is a really exciting opportunity for us to talk to someone in the financial world. In fact, as we started and launched this podcast, Scott is the first person from the financial markets who is being interviewed for a Game Face Exec. So he's our guinea pig, but he's also our pioneer. So thank you, Scott, for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's very kind for you, one who leads a top 40 bank in this country, to take the time to address some key questions that I have, and I'm sure that our listeners and our viewers are interested in. This is a very precarious time that we find ourselves in. When you and I are talking right now, we're just wrapping up the first half of 2020. And I've got to ask you, from a financial economic standpoint, when the year began, if you were to have written in your journal what you forecasted 2020 to look like, if we could have peeked back into your journal entry, what would we have read?
Well, you would have read that we thought 2020 was going to be a record year. You know, the economy in the areas that we operate in were strong. They were among the strongest in the country. People were optimistic. Job growth was high. Unemployment was low. People felt good about the future, and they were investing and spending. And so whenever you have that combination, it's always good for banks because we can step in and help them achieve their goals. So we were projecting growth in loans, growth in deposits, growth in fee income, growth across the board in all of our products and services. And obviously, that came to a screeching halt in March.
And so now that we're looking into the second half of the year, which seems like these are two completely different worlds that we're living in. In fact, they are. So can you put on your prognosticator cap for us and tell us, what is Zions Bank saying behind closed doors about the second half of 2020 and even into 2021? What are we looking
at? I think it's really interesting as you ask that question and as you think about the response. And before you project in the second half of this year and into 2021, I think you have to look at the second quarter of 2020 because that, I think, holds the key to what will happen. And as we came into the second quarter, it was probably one of the most difficult times we have ever seen as a nation. Obviously, we had the pandemic. Then here in Utah, we had earthquakes. Then we had the government shutdown. Then we had the death of George Floyd and all of that social unrest that came up from there. And so the question is, how will that impact going forward? But the key, and I think the interesting thing that happened this year in this crisis, which I call the COVID-19 recession, as opposed to the Great Recession about 10 years ago in 2008, 2009, 2010, is that back then it was a banking crisis. And if you recall, the banks had invested in a lot of residential real estate. The government had loosened the underwriting criteria, and so Freddie and Fannie had purchased a lot of real estate. People were buying real estate with nothing down as an investment, and they were hoping that as the market continued to move up, they could sell at a profit before they had to pay off their loan or start making their loan payments. And so when the market collapsed, banks were in a difficult situation. And if you recall, the government came in with about a $700 billion package to help banks through that. The banks had to pay it back, and the government took warrants as well as giving the money. But in this time, the government really stepped in, and this is not a banking crisis. Banking is strong. They are banks are well capitalized. The credit culture is just sterling. But it was a business crisis. It was a health crisis, and the government stepped in a different way, in that they provided huge amounts of money to individuals, to states, to counties, and most importantly, to businesses. The package, if you add everything together, it's probably about a $5 trillion package, $2.5 trillion under the CARES Act. And during that period of time, we put banks, which were the conduit of getting this money out to businesses, we put on a huge number of loans. My organization did over 43,000 of these loans for about $7 billion, which was the ninth largest lender in the what they call the Paycheck Protection Plan in the country. And so people, banks were working around the clock, literally 18, 20, 22 hours a night to try and process these and get them through. So the result is that there is a lot of money in the hands of businesses. And with the stimulus checks that went to the individuals, there's a lot of money in the hands of the individuals. And with the extra stimulus that was paid on unemployment, even if you are unemployed, you're making more money than many were when they were employed. And so we're in this interesting phenomenon. Now, most of this money, the Paycheck Protection Plan money, will be forgiven, or at least the hope is that it will be forgiven. And so it's really a huge help to help businesses get back on track, to bring their people back and continuing to pay their employees. And the question is, how will that move forward? If the economy can start up with this extra engine, then I think we will see a recovery sort of like the Nikes, since we're talking about the Nikes. It won't be V-shaped, it won't be U-shaped, but it will be a Nike shape.
A Nike swoosh.
Yeah. And that will be good. The question, though, is going to be, if the economy doesn't come back, if people are not brought back on payroll, then come September, as we enter into the fourth quarter of 2020, when a lot of these benefits end and the unemployment $600 premium ends, what will happen? Will people have the money to continue making their payments on their cars and make their rent payments on their apartments? Will businesses be able to continue doing business if they're not open up fully? And so that's the question mark. And then the biggest question mark is, and it's especially true here in Utah, as we are seeing these spikes in COVID-19 cases, will there be a second shutdown? And if there is, I think we are in real trouble as an economy. If we don't have a second shutdown, if we learn to live with the virus, if we find a treatment for the virus and a vaccine that will get us over it, then I think we'll see the economy grow, because the fundamentals are there, especially in our market. Job growth is good. Unemployment is still relatively good compared to the nation as a whole, and we have a very diverse economy, which helps. And I think also for our particular market, you will see a lot of individuals who can now work remotely, and in fact are being encouraged to work remotely, that they are going to be moving from Seattle and San Francisco and Los Angeles and Atlanta, and they are going to be coming to Salt Lake City and Boise, and they're going to be enjoying our environment, our lifestyle here, and yet they'll have an East Coast or West Coast salary.
So, Scott, you know, historically, especially in times like this, I think that the banking industry either enjoys a reputation of being helpful, supportive, sometimes our last backstop as a small business, as I am, for example. And in other cases, it seems like banks and big banks in particular are viewed as the boogeyman. They're viewed as no one's helper. They're portrayed as greedy and such. Yeah. So how do you respond to those two labels, if you will? And what do you ensure at Zions Bank to make sure, or what do you do to ensure that your reputation is where you want it to be in times like this?
Well, I think I would start out by saying our industry hasn't done a good job in explaining the critical role that it plays in the economy. And oftentimes we become a scapegoat that the economy's not doing well because of banks. The consumer is hurting because of the high interest rates or because we don't lend fairly. We discriminate in how we make our loans. And I think that first you have to come and say, what do banks really do? And you have to appreciate the very important job that banks do. And I think it became clear during this COVID recession, when the economy shut down, banks were one of the few industries that it was said it was essential. They had to be open. And we had to adapt to a new environment. Now, having said that, as we tried to put these paycheck protection loans together, or the PPP loans, some banks said, we're not going to do it. Others said, we're only going to do so much. And so there was a great dissatisfaction among about 30% of clients of the banking industry that just said, you know, where's the long-term relationship benefit of dealing with the bank? And so I think you'll see a lot of a change in switching of banks as we move forward. But having said that, other banks, and I like to think that my institution is one of them, really went out to help. And while we honor the healthcare workers as unsung heroes saving lives, I think we should also honor bankers who have saved the economy and saved businesses and helped the business move forward and become sustainable again. And during this period, they were working, as I said earlier, 18 to 20 hours a night for weeks to try and get the work done and get the money immediately in the hand of businesses. But it's a difficult situation. And this is where you need to use your influence. This is where you have to figure out how to call in chips. This is where you have to figure out how do you create value in the community and get credit for it at the same time that you're creating value for your customers. And so banking hasn't done a good job of explaining that crucial role that we play, and so people don't understand it. But I think what's interesting is that while they may say, I don't have great faith, or I'm upset at the banking industry, or they're not fair, if you ask them about their local branch or their local banker, they always have high regards for them. And I think that shows that banking is a personal business. It's built on trust. It's built on establishing strong ties with your banker, the banker with the client, the banker with the community. And so on a local level, you know, the banking reputation, I think, is very good and very strong. On a national level, you know, banks don't rate high on the reputational scale.
Is there a skill set or an attribute that people getting into the banking industry today should work to develop so that that communication of the value and the good that is found in banking and the services of banking could be better communicated, not to mention those people who are already in it, those who've been in it for decades, such as yourself.
Well, I think we have to do a better job. And I don't think it's just who comes into banking, but I think it's how we advertise what we do. Obviously, I can't talk about who my clients are, and I can't talk about the deals that I do. But we have to talk more about, and we have to especially exert greater influence among thought leaders and people in the Capitol, on Capitol Hill, here in Utah, and in Congress, on what we do, and that we are there helping small businesses. We're there helping consumers. We're not only going after large corporations, and we are there to provide value to everyone on the economic ladder and try and help them improve and grow.
Well, when we spoke about the financial crisis of 10 years ago, 2008, 2009, obviously there were certain things that your bank had to do to respond to that. You had to participate in certain moves, and you had to you had to do things that were not anticipated in order to help yourself get through that and also all of your many customers. You're doing the same thing now, 10 years later, in this new unexpected crisis. But are there some common traits, or are there some common values or strategies even that you're tapping back into to help you and your leadership team, and not to mention your local branches, to get through this? What is that thread or that theme that we would have heard 10 years ago that's now coming back today?
Yeah, well, I think there are several lessons that were learned and that they are still applicable now. The first is that you have to be good at what you're doing. You have to make good, sound loans. You have to have sound concentration limits and underwriting policies. And you have to be out in the market. But beyond that, you have to communicate very well. Communicate to your employees, communicate to your customers, and communicate to the political leaders. You have to communicate. And then I think you have to be very agile. And I think that's one thing that's coming out of this COVID-19 recession, is that the importance of being able to turn on a dime and to come up with new things. And I think what this has done, it's moved some things that banks have been thinking about for years, and it's now happening right now. So working remotely has been a discussion probably for 10 years. And many think, would say, can't be done. You know, we can't trust the cloud. We can't track what people are doing. And overnight, we had 75% of our employees working remotely, and it worked. You know, again, the unsung heroes were our technology people, but it worked. And so people are able to do it. We can now sign documents online. And some of the concerns that we had, we've been able to work around. So I think being agile and turning on a dime is a lesson learned back then and is really important today. I think the other is that we have to look to the future. We have to think, what is the future going to be? And we can't lose the advantages or the lessons that we've learned and hoping that we will go back to the old way of doing it. But we can't, we have to look to the future and say, we are going to come out of this, but it's going to be a new operating environment. It's going to be a better operating environment. It's going to be more digital than it ever has been. It's going to be more conversations through Zoom and less in-person meetings. And so how do you develop the relationship through a computer screen? What else do you do? And I think the combination of having really good technology, all of the digital channels that are that work, and having a feeling of a long-term relationship sort of the old traditional long-term relationship, and matching that with an in-person a banker that you can meet with, that you can talk to, that you can call, that's the winning solution going forward.
As you talk about that, an image came into my mind, Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, right?
Yeah.
He was a banker who looked after the community and tried to do the right thing, even when it was difficult. And I think we'd all love to have a relationship like that with our banker, whether it's for a home loan or whether it's for a business loan. So talk a little bit more, though, about the innovation that's coming. We're not asking you to disclose, of course, any trade secrets that Zions may be developing, but just the necessity of, you talked about being agile and nimble. And when it comes to technology, I think about all of the bricks and mortar branches. If I'm not mistaken, you have branches in 2 states, but you have offices in 10 states. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what all those offices represent in those various states, primarily in the West. But how is this changing the traditional banking environment of, I pull up to the bank, I walk in and I sit down with my banker, or I go up to the teller? How is that going to be different, say, a year or even 5 years from now?
Well, I think it's interesting. And you'll have some people say branches are going to go away, you know, and they're going to be replaced by an online banking platform. But in my view, you know, what I see is that what people want is a combination of both. So you have fintech companies out there where you can do all of your banking online and you never talk to anyone. There's no office that you can go into. Mm. And when those companies first came out, their goal was to destroy and put banks out of business. They realized they can't do that. And so now they're trying to partner with banks with their technology. And what I is that the role of the branch will change. You may not go into the branch as often to do a teller transaction or to cash a check or make a deposit, but you are going to go in there to see your banker, to get advice on a mortgage or get advice on an investment or get advice on a commercial loan. And you may then work at home on the online application. You may call them, you may go back and forth. And so the platform that you need as a bank is that it's online and someone can do all of the application online at home, or they can start it at the bank and then finish it at home, or they can start it at home and finish it at the bank. But tied to that technology is someone there giving advice and to answer questions. And again, I think that's a winning combination, that if you just had a fintech company without a bank, that you wouldn't do. And so I think branches will be around, but they won't be teller transaction branches. They'll be offices where you go into to meet with experts in lending and investment and cash management and treasury services, where you can come in and get advice on products and services that will help your company grow, to help you manage your capital better, and to increase your cash flow.
Well, when you talk about those people that I would come in and meet with, if you'll forgive me, I call them salespeople, right? Because they're in the business of influencing and providing me an education, helping me see things that I might not otherwise see on my own. My research may not have exposed certain laws or regulations or even some traps that may rest between me and where I'm trying to go. So that kind of consultative relationship is absolutely critical between me and my banker. And so I'm wondering, could you give us some insight as to when an applicant is coming into Zions Bank, whether they're looking for a new business loan or they want to remodel their home or whatever it may be, can you just describe some common attributes that the successful applicant brings so that they can, in fact, get what they're looking for from your bank?
Yeah, I will, but I would first go back to your original comment. Bankers are salespeople, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think what's important, they're not out there to sell the wrong product, and they're not being commissioned to sell a certain product. That bankers are there, and they're salespeople in the sense, as you said, that they are to sit down and explain options and to say, here's this, and to exert their influence to try and guide you to what they think is the best suited for your needs. Because banks don't, and it's certainly with our bankers, they don't want to sell you any product that you don't need or that won't help you. They want to sell products that will help you grow, to help you manage your capital better, to help you manage your sales better, to help you manage your cash flow better, because if they're able to do that, you're going to come back to them because you'll appreciate their advice, you'll appreciate the services and products that they gave, and that you'll see that those products and services, that advice, that counsel, actually created value for you. And so I think when a customer comes in, if they come in with the idea that I'm going to be sitting down with someone who can help me, and if they're asking for the right questions, and if they come in prepared to share information, then it's a winning situation. And I think the best quality for a bank customer to have is that they're open, they're transparent, and they share information with their banker even before they have to, especially if there's a problem developing. And likewise, I think those are the same traits that a great banker has. They're open, they're transparent, they're honest, and they share the right information for the benefit of the client. Because our goal is the same. The client wants to grow and be successful. We want to give them the right products to help them grow and to help them be successful. And then everyone wins.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm curious, though, how much of the transaction really just comes down to numbers. It's not so much personality. It's not relationship. It's just, do you qualify or don't you based on the math, based on the regulations that we're operating under as a bank? And that, I think that's the cynicism that sometimes seeps into the customer's mind when they have to walk into a bank. And I'm certainly not saying this about Zions Bank. I'm gonna generalize, though. I don't want to feel like walking into a bank is the same as walking onto a stereotypical car lot, right? Where it's either I qualify or I don't, and it's all just it comes down to the numbers. Yeah. But am I naive to think that it could be something more than that?
Well, it should be something more than that. But I think you have to weigh two things. One is government regulations, and especially the idea of fair lending, where we don't treat different people differently, and so you have that on the one hand. The other hand is that the customer, especially on certain transactions, wants speed. If you want a mortgage, you want that mortgage done fast. And if you're a real estate broker, you want that your customer to get that mortgage fast so you can close the deal. If you're trying to get a credit card, you want it instantaneous. And to do that, you really have to have artificial intelligence and online capabilities where you can process these deals. And so if you combine all of that together, fair lending, not discriminating, you know, the numbers become more important and as we try and treat everyone the same. But beyond that, you know, character still means a lot. The numbers may say I should lend to you, but I know that your character is such that I don't want to. And so you don't. And so, you know, character means a lot. You know, the project means a lot. The impact it will have on the community means a lot. You know, is it a community development investment? Is it a community development loan? And so all of that comes into play. But the smaller the deal, you know, the more artificial intelligence and the more machine learning is involved in getting it done fast so that the customer gets what they want and they get it at the right rate. The larger the deal, the more complex the deal, then that's when you have more interaction and a lot of other elements come into play besides the numbers.
Scott, you said earlier that you can't disclose clients, and we certainly respect that. I am curious, though, if there was a particular project that came across your desk in your banking career that at face value, you may have looked at it and thought, there's no way we're going to get a deal done here, but I want to do a deal. I want to find a way to make this work. Is there one particular example that you think about that you could share with us? Or again, are there qualities of those types of deals that may have looked difficult at the front end, but through whatever creativity or ingenuity that you exercised, that your bank exercised, and that your customer exercised, you were actually able to get across the finish line?
Well, I'll give you an example. It wasn't a deal that I did or that Zions Bank did, and it wasn't a deal that happened recently. But I think it's a terrific example, especially in this environment. Before I came to Zions, I was with Bank of America. And one of my clients in San Francisco was the Golden Gate Bridge Authority. And the Golden Gate Bridge was built during the Great Recession. And a group of citizens got together and said, we need a work project to get our people back to work. And we need to connect the San Francisco Peninsula across the bay so that we can go up and improve commerce. People said it can't be done. The currents in the bay are too strong. You could never build a bridge there. The winds are too strong. And it's suicidal. Back then, there were no government handouts or funding for a project like that. But the banker, the founder of Bank of America, A.P. Giannini, said, we are going to do it because if it works, it'll transform our entire community. It will pull us out of the Great Recession. It'll put people back to work. It will increase our commerce. It will expand our markets, and it will make a difference in the lives of everyone else. But if it doesn't work, it's going to bankrupt all of us. And so he decided to do it. And he issued the bonds. He bought the bonds that financed the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge. The bridge was built. And it's an icon today, and it did everything that they had hoped it would do. And as I've thought of going into banking, and as I think of staying into banking, I keep thinking of that example, because I think the role of the banker should be exactly like AP Giannini did back in the 1930s, that they should have broad vision, that they should be a community developer. They should look at what's best for the community and find creative ways to meet those needs. And that was done not by numbers. It was done evaluating the risks carefully, but making a decision that did have risk and could have failed, but it didn't.
I'm really encouraged to hear a prominent banker like you speak that way and talk about, you know, weighing risk, but also weighing reward, not just for your own entity and for your own personal gain, but also for the good of the community. Define community however you will. But that's very encouraging, because let's tell a lawyer joke right now, just between you and me. Most people say the lawyers have no appetite for risk, right? They have not a creative bone in their body. They just want to protect their client from any kind of potential harm. And I've certainly experienced that in my life, working with and even having lawyers as clients. But when I find a creative lawyer who has that kind of entrepreneurial thinking, that blood running through their veins, for me, it's refreshing. And that's just the way I am. I tend to be more of a risk taker. And so to hear that from a banker as experienced as you, boy, I got to tell you, that's so encouraging. But
I think one of the stereotypes of bankers that is wrong is that we are conservative and we're not very innovative. And I think banking is really very innovative, and a good banker is very creative. We call it trying to be conservatively entrepreneurial, that we want to be nimble, we want to be innovative, we want to bring creative solutions to the table to help the clients. And if you look, we do. In the past, if you go back 20 years, if you wanted to make a deposit, you had to come into the bank and give the checks to the bank. The bank then would process those checks and would send the check back to whoever wrote it. And then you'd file those checks in shoe boxes because you had to maintain a record. We developed a technology at Zions where you could do all of that automatically, and you could process electronically, and you don't have to give the check back to the original writer of the check. We had to get the laws changed, and President Clinton actually signed the Check 21 Act that allowed that to happen. But now every time you go into a grocery store, and if you give them a check and they run it through their machine and hand it back to you, that is technology that was developed by a bank. And you look at bank card, no one thinks of the charge card as being innovative now, but back in its day, it changed how banking was done. The whole idea that you could charge on a card and pay it back over time was unheard of. That was developed by Bank of America. That became the Visa card, and then you look at online mortgages and online account. You look at the information that you can give back to the customer and on how they're spending, where they're writing their checks, if this is a check that they actually wrote or if it's fraud coming in. And all of those things are innovations that came from banks. And so banking is creative, and it has to be creative going forward to exist.
Speaking of creativity then, behind me, for those watching on video, you can see a couple of items. First of all, we have a Vince Carter jersey behind me today in honor of his retirement that was just recently announced. So big props to Vince Carter, great professional athlete. And also behind me, we have a flag of Brigham Young University Athletics. And because Zions is a Utah-based company,
yeah,
and because I work with BYU Athletics and you're a sponsor of BYU Athletics,
we wanted to
fly this flag behind me here today. So go Cougars. But I have to ask you, for those who aren't familiar with Zions Bank throughout the country, Zions is extremely involved in sports marketing, and you have a prominent role not only with BYU Athletics, with the Utah Jazz, and I'm sure there are other teams and athletic departments, some of which I don't want to name because I may not be a fan of theirs, but you really see sports marketing as a way to drive Zions' business. So can you share with us, especially those who are listening who are in the sports business, who may be calling on people like you, wanting to develop that kind of partnership, what are some of the imperatives that you have to see in order for you to make an investment in a sports property?
Well, you're right. We have made a huge investment in a number of sports franchises where we buy tickets, we're a sponsor, we're a supporter, we provide banking services. And we do it because it's a way to reach our people. I mean, if you go to a Jazz game and you have 20,000 people sitting there, or you go to a BYU football game and you have a stadium full of people, they see that you're there. They associate you with their team. And that develops an affinity that we can come back and take advantage of. And it's interesting. We also support the sports hub at the University of Utah, and Utah and BYU are competitors. But it doesn't matter to the customer. some customers are thrilled that we are up there at the University of Utah, and they sort of snicker at the why. The why customers are thrilled that we're down there, but it makes sense. And so we're doing something that brings great activity to the community. At the same time, it gives us great exposure to the people who are there physically, but also through the radio and TV, and it allows us to support major businesses in our local community. And these sports businesses are major businesses in our community.
So what could those sports businesses do to cause you to disengage from them, to say, we're not renewing that partnership? It's been a good ride, but we're moving on. What are some things that they need to be watching out for so that they never hear those words out of your mouth?
Well, I think one is cost. I mean, we can go up so high, and then beyond that, there's not a financial value to it. So I think it's always to have a wide range of sponsorships that you can find the right place for your organization in there, so that you can always be part of it. And knowing that, others may come in ahead of you, which is okay. It's not an exclusive relationship. And have the sports franchise recognize that you can do your part, but you may not be able to do more than that. And so to have a wide variety of options, each with certain benefits and each with different costs.
So part of your reasoning for partnering with sports is because you talked about community, and that Zions Bank wants to be viewed as an integral part of any community. I want to talk a little bit as we wrap up here, a little bit about corporate social responsibility. There's been so much discussion of late as we're talking today about social responsibility of individuals and of course of companies. Now, how do we ensure that CSR is not just a token effort by a company? When you have opportunities brought to you and they're laid out on your desk, how do you judge whether or not a particular opportunity to do something within the community has value and real meaning and real purpose versus something that just looks like a feel-good PR move?
Well, we do look at that, and we try and evaluate that. The challenge is that there are probably more projects that have real value than you can do, or that anyone, one company can do. And so we try to be as broad as we can in our approach. Some are large sponsorships, some are smaller sponsorships. But as we look at it, we say, what impact will this have on the business that we're sponsoring? Is it a good business? Is it a business that we will be proud of to have our name associated with it? And there are some businesses that we wouldn't sponsor because we would not want to be associated with that. So that's the first criteria. The second criteria is how is it viewed in the community? Will this help the community by providing good entertainment, by providing a good product and service, by doing any number of good things? But if there's a good impact, if it's a company that we want to do business with, if it helps the economy grow and expand, then we are there and try to do as much as we can.
Well, Scott, this has been very enlightening. I really appreciate the insights you've given me. I'm sure those who are listening have gained a lot from this. To be able to pick the brain of someone who's been in the banking industry, what's going on, 30 years?
30 years.
Right. So for those who are getting into the financial sector, let's imagine that I have one of my sons, wink, wink, who's going into the financial sector. This slowdown in the economy has a little bit affected that, but he's got plans. He'll be moving to New York City soon to take a job with a financial institution there. What can you say to encourage someone like that. Is this the right time to get into banking? Should he just kind of go in with just a lot of hope that things are going to work out, or should he be maybe looking at another career?
Well, I'm glad that he's looking at it, because I think banking is really a noble profession. And I think you do a lot to, as I said earlier, create value for your customers, your community, your shareholders, and your employees. And so I think people should be proud to go into banking, and they should recognize that it's a great opportunity to be involved with people, helping them in some of their most important situations. At the same time, you're helping them in some of their most difficult situations, and you're trying to create value. So you go into it and you get a lot of positive and a lot of negative feedback, but you're doing good. And the second piece of advice I'd give them is that it's a creative industry, as I've said, and they need to come in and say, it's creative. We may have rules, we may have guidelines, but the great banker is one who can look at them and look at the project and say, I understand the risk, but this is the right thing to do. And this is how we can do it to benefit our client, to benefit our community, to benefit the economy. And then I think you always have to find balance. Banking is an industry where it can just suck all of your time out. You know, there's always deadlines. There's always a client that's pushing to get it done. And it's easy to spend your nights and your weekends working for your clients. But to be a great banker, I think you also have to find that balance where you are putting aside the books and rejuvenating yourself and coming back with more vigor. So especially in New York, especially in that environment back there, they should take time for themselves.
Good advice coming from someone who's worked internationally. You worked in Tokyo early in your career. You've worked in San Francisco, as you mentioned earlier. You were schooled on the East Coast. In fact, at universities that come from very major markets. So I'm going to pass that advice on to him. I'm sure he'll be grateful for it. Scott, this has been, as I say, very insightful. Thank you for spending the time and giving us a peek into your world and how you and bankers think, because I think we can all take something from what you have said and make our own banking relationships much more successful moving forward. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much. And thanks what you do to help keep us on target and sharp, and knowing how we can use our influence better.
Thank you, Scott.
Good. Thanks.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.